Good evening and welcome. I'm Donna Cease. I'm the Spiritual Program Coordinator at Kadampa Center. And we're really excited to have you here for tonight. And I hope you'll stay for the whole weekend of teachings with Don Handrick. He's back here visiting the Kadampa Center for the second time. Don is resident teacher for half the year at Tubton Norbu Ling in Santa Fe, and the other half of the year he travels and blesses other FPMT centers visiting as a visiting teacher. So I first encountered Don at the first Light of the Path retreat in 2009, where he was leading one of the discussion groups, and he was very kind and gentle and articulate and really knew his stuff, and he's had 10 more years to learn his stuff, so I think you'll enjoy him. He's going to be teaching this weekend on the Four Measurables prayer, which we do every Sunday, so that'll be really nice to hear his insights into how we can incorporate that into our daily lives. Our schedule for the weekend, we're meeting again tomorrow from 10 to 4 and Sunday from 10:30 to 4. We encourage people to bring your lunch, and we'll all sit around and talk about what we heard in the morning during lunchtime. And Don is going to be staying and joining us at lunchtime, so that's an extra reason to bring your lunch and stay. A couple of things coming up. We're going to be having a farewell party next Saturday at 4:30 for Gay Norbu. Not everybody here knows him, or you might have seen him. He comes when we have major pujas for holy days. You'll see him. He's sometimes in robes, sometimes not. He first came here with the Shiva tour in 2003 and stayed on to raise a couple of his nephews who were here in the country. And now he's going back to Tibet to be with his mother. And so he'll be gone. So do come if you're inclined. We're going to have a little celebration for him next Saturday. And immediately after that, we'll have a Tara practice in here, so that'll be a good way to send him off. And then next Sunday, Geshe Gelug will be back. So we'll all have a chance to offer katas, and we're going to try to do a special flower offering for him also. So please come and enjoy Geshe's return. Jill asked me to mention that they're going to be painting the front lobby area this week, and she needs volunteers on Wednesday, Thursday, Friday, and Saturday. So if you're able to come and help with that, talk to Jill. We had our blood drive, our second annual blood drive as our gift to His Holiness on his birthday, and we were able to collect 24 units of blood today. So that's really wonderful. Rejoice in that. And then last, I'll just mention that this visit from Don, just like Kadampa Center, just like everything that we experience in this world of phenomena, is a dependent arising, and none of it happens without all the components that come together to make it happen. Some of that is our desire to have the teachings. Some of that is our ability to make the teachings happen. And part of our ability to make the teachings happen is the ability to pay the costs that are involved in bringing a teacher. So if you are moved at any time this weekend by what you hear, we welcome any donations. There are donation boxes right outside. There's one right outside the Gompador. And you can give by texting. And if we have somebody, you know, you can give in the bookstore if there's somebody here present who's trained. There is tonight. I'm not skilled in that, so Jill can do it. But she prefers you to give online. And yes, you can also give online. And I forgot to mention that Don will also be teaching the first session of the next Discovering Buddhism class on transforming problems into happiness, and that will be this coming Monday night at 7. So with that, we can just relax, and he should be in the Gompa shortly.
Let's start tonight on page 73. I like to recite this praise to Shakyamuni Buddha. We won't do this before every session, but I think it's nice to do it tonight. Okay. Page 73. So this first verse we'll do three times, and then we'll continue to the middle of page 76. To the founder, the endowed, transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme God of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan. I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. To the founder, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the one gone beyond, the foe destroyer, the completely perfected, fully awakened being, perfect in knowledge and in good conduct, Sugata, knower of the world, supreme guide of human beings to be tamed, teacher of gods and human beings, to you, the completely and fully awakened one, the endowed transcendent destroyer, the glorious conqueror, the subduer from the Shakya clan, I prostrate, make offerings, and go for refuge. When, O Supreme amongst humans, you were born on this earth, you paced out seven strides, then said, I am supreme in this world. To you who were wise, then I prostrate. With pure bodies, form supremely pure, wisdom ocean like a golden mountain, fame that blazes in the three worlds, winner of the best, Lord, to you I prostrate. With the supreme signs, face like spotless moon, color like gold, to you I prostrate. Dust free like you, the three worlds are not. Incomparably wise one, to you I prostrate. The Savior having great compassion, the Founder having all understanding, the field of merit with qualities like a vast ocean, to you the one gone to thusness I prostrate. The purity that frees one from attachment, the virtue that frees one from the lower realms, the one path, the sublime pure reality, to the Dharma that pacifies, I prostrate. Those who are liberated and who also show the path to liberation, the holy field qualified with realizations, who are devoted to the moral precepts, to you, the sublime community intending virtue, I prostrate. Homage to the Supreme Buddha. Homage to the Dharma refuge, homage to the great Sangha, to all three a devout homage, to all worthy of respect, bowing with bodies as many as all realms, atoms, in all aspects, with supreme faith I pay homage. Do not commit any non-virtuous actions, perform only perfect virtuous actions, subdue your mind thoroughly. This is the teaching of the Buddha. A star, a visual aberration, a flame of a lamp, an illusion, a drop of dew or a bubble, a dream, a flash of lightning, a cloud. See conditioned things as such. Through these merits may sentient beings attain the rank of all seeing, subdue the foe of faults, be delivered from samsara's ocean, perturbed by the waves of aging, sickness, and death. So let's recite the prayer of the Four Immeasurable Thoughts. I don't know if everyone has the handout that was prepared for the weekend. But if you don't, you can go to 177. And the same prayer, I think this is the same version that I have on the sheet there as what's in the book on page 177. So I'll be going through these four immeasurable thoughts, but all of you, I'm sure, have some understanding of these four already. So as you recite this, try to bring these to mind. And what we'll do is we'll recite each of these with the four lines, and I'll give a little bit more explanation of that tonight already. But we'll go through each of them and just pause briefly after each of these, trying to cultivate that thought. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were to abide in equanimity, free of hatred and attachment. May they abide in equanimity. I myself will cause them to abide in equanimity. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this. So sorry, there was a slight change in that first one, but I think the other ones are all okay. If you don't have the sheet, you can again use page 177. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings had happiness and the causes of happiness. May they have happiness and its causes. I myself will cause them to have happiness and its causes. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this. And then immeasurable compassion. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were free of suffering and its causes. May they be free of suffering and its causes. I myself will cause them to be free of suffering and its causes. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this. And then immeasurable joy. How wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were never separated from the happiness of higher rebirth and liberation. May they never be separated from these. I myself will cause them never to be separated from these. Please, Guru Deity, grant me blessings to be able to do this. And then before we begin, just one more prayer, and that'll be on page 98 of the prayer book. We'll do refuge in bodhicitta before the teaching. Let's do this once in English and then twice in the Tibetan. I go for refuge until I am enlightened to the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Supreme Assembly. By the merits I create through listening to the Dharma, may I become a Buddha in order to benefit all sentient beings. Sangye chodang soki choknam la jang chu bardu dakni kyab su chi daki chunyan gi pe sonam gi drola penshir sangye drupar shug sangye chodang soki choknam la jang chu bardu dakni kyab suci daki chenyan gi pe sonam gi drola penshir sangye drupar shong. Okay, then let's do a short meditation before we begin, just to give ourselves a chance to come into this space, let go of whatever distractions we might have in our minds, focus the mind a bit. So find a good meditation posture, one that where the body is comfortable, and yet make sure that there's an uprightness to the body, kind of an alertness, attentiveness, that we also want to have in our minds. So it can be difficult to meditate, particularly after a long day like today. But just do your best. We're going to do a few minutes of focused meditation on the breath. And if you have a technique that you already use to work with the breath, then by all means you can do that. If not, I generally suggest that people use this point at the tip of the nose, where you feel the sensation of the air coming in through the nostrils and then going back out through the nostrils. Making that your focal point, just stay with the breath as best as you can, trying not to let the mind get distracted. But no doubt that will happen. And whenever it does, when we notice that suddenly we're thinking about things that are on our minds currently, preoccupations or concerns about future plans or something that happened recently that's still on your mind, or maybe even you get distracted by sounds or other sensations in the body, whenever the mind gets kind of taken away from the breath, then our job is to place the mind back on the breath, to let go of whatever it was that distracted us, and without any judgment, return to the breath. So we'll do this in silence for just a few minutes after I ring the bell here, and then I'll lead you in a short reflection to set our motivation for tonight. So now to set our motivation for being here tonight, I thought we would start off this course with a few quotes that help us to really reinforce what we're doing this weekend in this class that we've titled The Four Paths to Awaken a Kind Heart. And the first one is from His Holiness the Dalai Lama, whose birthday we're celebrating today. And he says, developing a kind heart does not involve any of the sentimental religiosity normally associated with it. It is for everyone. irrespective of race, religion, or political affiliation. It is for anybody who considers themselves a member of the human family. Another quote that was posted recently by Bill Kane, that's from Kadrola. Many of you know of her, amazing being who has been in our organization helping out with so many things. And she says, "People try spiritually to achieve realization. The true realization is to achieve a kind heart. Other than that, there is nothing really that is useful, nothing else. Realistically, there is good and bad, the things that we can completely trust that will never betray us or fail us, our kind-heartedness and bodhicitta." So both of these great masters emphasize the need for us to work on developing a kind heart. And our initial motivation in being here tonight can embrace the idea that we ourselves benefit from having more kindness in our hearts, being more compassionate and caring, loving. Recall from your own experience how you feel when you're in those states of mind and how good this is for you. We see that we are most in touch with our true nature when we are kind-hearted. So our initial motivation is to be here because we ourselves will benefit from the work we do this weekend. We ourselves will experience the effects that are very positive from cultivating these states of mind. But in the Mahayana tradition, we are always embracing the idea that we're here as well for others, if not even primarily for others. Because while we will benefit from the work that we do here, we primarily practice developing a kind heart so that we can be of the greatest benefit to others. We come to understand that their situation is fundamentally no different from our own. Every single being in the exact same predicament that we ourselves find ourselves in. So as you embark on tonight's teaching and this weekend, think that you're here to develop a kind heart, primarily so that it can be a benefit to others, so that you can then help others to find the happiness that they seek, to be free from the suffering that they experience. You're here to work on yourself so that you can be better qualified to accomplish that. As His Holiness says, we may not be able to benefit others to the degree we'd like right now, but we have to prepare ourselves to do so. So this weekend is kind of our kind heart boot camp, our ability to go in and do the work that will help us to be of greater benefit to others. And this is the mind of bodhicitta that is intent upon helping all beings to the greatest degree by developing ourselves fully, by becoming a Buddha for their sake. And just try to hold that intention very deeply in your heart, so that it will be the guiding force behind all the work that we do tonight and through the weekend. Okay, good. So first of all, I want to thank you all for inviting me here. This is my second time teaching at Kadampa Center. I was here just a little over a year ago, I think, last June. And it's just wonderful to be back here again. Is there anybody who's brand new to Buddhism? Anybody in the room? Don't be shy. No? Everybody's got some background. Okay, good. So if I don't have to do quite as much of a sort of introduction into this topic tonight, does everyone have the handouts, by the way? Make sure that you do get a set, because we will be using this throughout the weekend, and even tonight we'll start with the first session that's there in terms of talking about the first of these four immeasurables. So, as all of you know, I mean, when we talk about spiritual practice in Buddhism, you know, we're always talking about the mind, And I'm sure many of you have taken the courses that are offered here in terms of discovering Buddhism, about mind and its potential. But essentially what we're talking about in Buddhism when we refer to mind is that element of our experience that is in the mental horizon. It's the continual awareness, consciousness that we have moment after moment. And this, of course, is the workshop that the Buddha has directed us to spend our time, you know, developing, is to look at our minds and to understand that everything comes from our minds. And this is essentially kind of what all these teachings that we're going to look at this weekend are built around, is the idea that we have what we call negative states of mind. Those negative states are what produce suffering. They produce suffering in the moment because they are disturbing emotions. We frequently use that term. But they are also negative emotions because they produce suffering in the future. They are what cause us to be, you know, continually experiencing dissatisfaction, pain, suffering, and so on. Whereas those positive states of mind, we do feel better in the moment. They do have that positive quality, but they also produce results of happiness. And of course, this is the essential teaching that all of Buddhism is built upon, is the idea that we are in control of our own experiences. That by devoting ourselves to this path of diminishing the negative states of mind and increasing the positive ones, we can do this to a limitless degree. We can eventually be rid of the negative ones entirely. And we can know the full fruition of everything that is positive to this limitless or immeasurable degree. So this weekend we're working on these four immeasurables that are really very much a part of our Mahayana tradition, though they are also taught in all of the Buddhist traditions. So I'll go into that a little bit. I'm not going to spend a lot of time talking about the differences and how these are taught in the various traditions. We're going to mostly look at them from the perspective of the Mahayana. But these are some of the most positive minds that we can create because they really reinforce this mind of bodhicitta that we just meditated on very briefly. And that'll actually be the final session on Sunday afternoon. We'll kind of wrap this all into the teachings on bodhicitta and how what we've done here this weekend reinforce the cultivation of that mind that is the most powerful mind that we can have, the greatest motivation that we can bring to all of our actions. So essentially, when we talk about this pathway of working with our minds, we are trying to create kind of antidotal states, states that bring down and diminish everything that is negative, and then, of course, those that enhance what is positive. And what we're going to see is that these are kind of directly, you know, kind of doing the same work. To the degree that we diminish those that are negative, we are also increasing the potential for those that are positive. And the stronger that we make those that are positive, the less chance of the negative states of mind arising. So as we go through each of these, we'll be taking a look at that and kind of applying an understanding of the four immeasurables to what we call their sort of far enemies, the states of mind that they are directly contradictory towards. And then also we'll make sure that we're kind of in line with the understanding of them correctly by looking at what are called the near enemies of these, which is when we kind of might miss the mark, to make sure that we're cultivating that mind in a very genuine way. So the four immeasurables are taught in, as I said, all the traditions. In the Theravadan traditions, they are frequently called the four divine abodes or Brahma abodes. The Brahma Vihara is the Pali for these. And they're practiced in a slightly different order than what we're going to be going through here. And even in the Mahayana tradition, sometimes you see these four in a different order. So if you have the prayer in front of you, you'll see that we have immeasurable equanimity first, followed by love, by compassion, and then by joy. If you go to even some of the other versions of the four immeasurables in our prayer book, but certainly if you go to the Theravadan tradition, you'll see that equanimity is always placed last. And there's some rationale that they have for doing that. But nonetheless, in the Mahayana tradition, we're frequently basing all of our kind of these wholesome, positive thoughts that we have towards others on the foundation of equanimity. So tonight we'll be going into equanimity, and I'll give a bit more detail about why that is taught first in this tradition. But just know that you will see that difference in terms of how they're presented in some of the other traditions. Now, why are they called immeasurable? Does anyone know? So I don't have to teach it? I'm happy to teach it. But anyone have any idea? Why do we call these immeasurables? Yes, what's your name?
I'm Lori.
Lori?
Is it because they're immeasurable sentient beings?
This is one reason why we can talk about them, thanks, Lori, as being immeasurable, is because the foundation for them is immeasurable. The beings, we often talk about kind of infinite sentient beings or countless sentient beings. I mean, it makes it a little mind-boggling to even think about the number of sentient beings there must be, even just in this world, if you take into account all of the beings that are in the insect realm and the oceans. They say the oceans hold much and the larger quantity of sentient beings on this planet. We have, countless beings. So we use this word immeasurable to refer to the fact that when we cultivate them, we're cultivating them to all of those beings without exception. So we're kind of developing a very, very vast platform upon which these minds are being developed. So this is one reason why we can refer to them as immeasurable. Any other thoughts on why you could call them immeasurables? Okay, so let me give a few other thoughts that are, and actually one of the books that I'm going to be referring to, and I think there may be some copies in the bookstore if you're interested, it's a wonderful book by Venerable Sangye Kadro. She's writing under her Western name, Kathleen MacDonald, in this book called Awakening the Kind Heart. And I'm going to be pulling things from here occasionally, but also talking about a lot of this from my own experience of working with these. But in her book, in the very beginning, she goes into why these are called immeasurables, and of course the first one is because they're for all beings who are so numerous that they cannot be measured or counted. Yeah, I assume that at some point you could if you had the capacity to do so, but we can say that there are immeasurable beings, countless beings out there. The second one is that we create immeasurable positive energy and purify immeasurable negative energy when we cultivate them. This speaks to the power of these minds. And these two ideas are related. Because we have such a vast foundation that we're developing these minds on, the basis of, therefore they have incredible power. If we generate love or compassion towards one being, it's already very powerful. But if we use the platform of all beings that are as vast as space, that are countless and immeasurable, then we have incredible power behind these. So this is speaking to their power, their energy that we have when we cultivate them. And it can also be said that they're generated in one's own mind to an immeasurable or boundless degree. And this is kind of a more subjective side of it. Alex Berzin points this out in one of his teachings, that we can say that we can cultivate these in our hearts to a degree that we will never really experience the limit of. So this speaks to our own capacity, our own potential to have these minds at that level. So those three things are all involved in why we call them immeasurable. Because the basis is vast and countless, because there's incredible immeasurable power behind them, and that we also have, again, this idea that we can extend them in our own hearts. Our hearts aren't limited. His Holiness frequently talks about this. When we talk about anything that is mental, and, as I said earlier, Buddhism is talking about cultivating these all within our own minds, we don't have any limit to that, unlike our bodies. Every year when there's competitions, people do break new records in track and field and so on, right? People are always going a little bit further than the previous record. But at some point, people aren't going to be able to pole vault over the Eiffel Tower, right? This just isn't going to happen, at least with the size of humans as it is right now. So we know that there are limits in what we can do physically, but mentally there are no limits. Mentally we can make these limitless. We can make them, pervade all of our being. So this is an important aspect to understand with these four immeasurable thoughts, is we're trying to work on those three ideas through trying to advance the degree to which we can take other beings into that circle of awareness, which is a lot of the work that we're going to do this weekend. And by the way, this weekend I'm really hoping to do a meditation session in each of the remaining four sessions. We won't do another one tonight because of it being the evening and that, and mostly want to introduce the subject. But we'll start tomorrow morning, hopefully, with a meditation on equanimity, and then we will do a meditation on each of the other three in those sessions. We should have time to do that. So, again, this is this idea of the immeasurables, that it's really important to keep these in mind and to work as best as we can in the weekend of generating a greater awareness of that larger foundation by extending ourselves to greater and greater numbers of beings, different classes of beings, and so on. Also by certainly, continuing to strengthen the power of them in our own minds through continued meditation. And then, of course, to be able to make them boundless eventually. We won't have them boundless tonight or over the weekend, but we can make them so over time. So let's go back to the prayer then and look at also, you'll notice that each of these four has four individual thoughts within it. And we recited these together before we started tonight. And you'll see that the first one is always starts with how wonderful it would be. And I don't know, I usually call this kind of a sort of aspiration. I don't know if you might call it a wish or an aspiration, but it's sort of like, well, how wonderful it would be if I had $1 million, or how wonderful it would be if you had $1 million, or whatever the case might be. It's sort of just a thought of how amazing it would be if that were to happen. The second thought is kind of advancing it a little bit, and they frequently use the idea of like if you were a ruler of a kingdom or a queendom, whatever you want to have. If you were the ruler over all of these beings, you would be able to say, may that be so, and kind of make that decree. So these all start with may they, you know, abide in equanimity, may they have happiness and its causes and so on. So we make that strong kind of determination that this is going to come to pass, that we're going to be in a position to be able to enact that. So we're already moving in the direction of taking some personal responsibility. The third of these, the third line, is where we say, I myself will cause them to blah, 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 whatever each of the individual thoughts is. We could call this kind of an extraordinary thought, because we're going to kind of advance the thought of how wonderful it would be, and may they, to I myself will do this. I'm going to take responsibility for this, which, of course, is in the Mahayana tradition. So you actually won't see this kind of presentation in a Theravadan tradition that frequently, not to my awareness. Usually they just work with kind of the second idea of kind of may they abide in equanimity, may they have happiness and its causes, that idea. In the Mahayana, we always want to take things to that level of personal responsibility where we're saying, yes, this isn't good enough for me just to have this thought about how wonderful it would be and may they have that. I need to be the one to do that. Now, of course, no one of us is going to be able to do that for all beings, but we have to aspire to do that. That's part of our development of bodhicitta, is to have that underpinning that we are kind of signing up for that level of responsibility. And, of course, we're going to look at that throughout this course, particularly when we get to immeasurable love, to understand what's the basis for why we can do that or why we should feel compelled to do that. So the third one is the extraordinary thought. The fourth one is, again, kind of unique to the Mahayana and even, I think, somewhat unique to Tibetan Buddhism, where we invoke what is called here the guru deity. By guru deity, we're simply meaning that combination of what we would call our spiritual teachers or guides in the form of a Buddha. So deity doesn't mean, you know, a god of some sort. It means a Buddha, a figure that you're working with in that particular practice. For the sake of the weekend, what we're going to work with is forearm Chen Rezig. It's a very basic form of a Buddha that is the Buddha of compassion. But his four arms are actually said to represent these four immeasurable thoughts. They're kind of the underpinning for that Buddha in the work that Buddha does in helping us to develop these qualities. So we're going to invoke this simple, you know, visualization, and I'll give you some instruction on doing that. And then the idea is with this is you're making this immeasurable request, kind of, please, Guru Deity, you know, grant me blessings to be able to accomplish this task that I'm setting out to do for each of these four immeasurables. So in this way, we could say we have four kind of immeasurable thoughts within each immeasurable thought, an immeasurable aspiration, an immeasurable wish, an immeasurable extraordinary thought, and then an immeasurable request, because we're making this on the basis of the same foundation of all sentient beings in terms of their happiness, their equanimity, their freedom from suffering, and so on. So each of these has those four lines, and as we did tonight, we'll probably pause after each of those just to try to think about those thoughts and bring them very deeply into our heart, and then to feel the blessings, the inspiration from our gurus in the form of those Buddhas, again, the Buddha of compassion that we'll use in particular, though you could use any Buddha as a way to invoke their presence and receive the blessings from them. So as I said earlier, the order of the four immeasurable thoughts that we're going to go through is what's on the sheet here. You will see them in a slightly different order in some presentations. Any comments or questions before we dive into immeasurable equanimity? Okay. None? All right. Let's go ahead and go then to the session one handout, which again is the first page, goes to the top of the second page. And what I've done for each of these immeasurables is I've given you a little quote from Kathleen McDonald's book, just a nice way that she has of describing each of these. And we'll, of course, be going through tonight and getting a better understanding of exactly what is meant by each of these four immeasurables. So equanimity, she says, is an unbiased, impartial attitude that regards all beings as equally deserving of our respect and concern, our love and compassion. So sometimes this word equanimity is used in other Buddhist contexts. I just want to point that out because it's a frequently used word. It actually has three different meanings that it could be attributed to it. The first one is one that we're going to be working with here, which is this idea of having kind of an even-mindedness, not letting ourselves be kind of partial and biased in how we're looking at others. And again, we'll be exploring that in more detail tonight. The second way that equanimity is sometimes used is just to refer to a sort of neutral feeling. And so we might talk about the feeling of equanimity. In some texts, you might see references to that. And I'm just pointing it out so that you know that this word equanimity is used in other contexts, and it won't have the same meaning there. When we talk about that feeling, that we're talking about when our mind is kind of sort of flatlining, we have the pleasurable experiences where the mind gets kind of really charged up, and then we have the unpleasant experience where we go down, and then we have sort of the flatline experiences that are sort of neutral. Again, that's not what we're trying to achieve here, is a measurable, you know, neutrality towards everybody where we don't even think anything about anybody. We're just kind of hanging out in that space. We're going to be developing a different type of emotion with this mind of equanimity. But just know that equanimity sometimes refers to that sort of neutral state. Neutrality is not really kind of what we're aiming for here. We don't want to have, again, this sort of charge to the mind in one way or another, but we still want to have a mind that's very embracing of other beings, a mind that feels very good about this even-mindedness, this equal regard for all beings. The third way that equanimity is sometimes used that you see this particularly, those of you who've studied the teachings on calm abiding and how to develop this meditative state. Equanimity there is about the state of mind where the mind's in balance, where you don't need to kind of correct the mind because the mind's hanging out in this space that is an okay place to be. So it's a term referring to a specific state of mind that is induced through meditation, where we can be in a place of equanimity. We don't need to kind of, it's sort of like if you had a radio, oh, I'm dating myself here by showing a radio dial. But if you had a radio dial where you were trying to get the station in, you know, so you get to that place where you don't have to adjust it anymore because you got it in good. You know, that's kind of the idea behind this, is that once you get to a place where the mind can hang out in that meditative state, then it's a state of equanimity, a state of balance. So again, those two other uses that I mentioned, these last two, are not what we're talking about here. We're talking about, as I mentioned earlier, I've used the term even-mindedness, or I even like the word equal regard. The idea is that right now we have a bias in our mind that causes us to have a different reaction to whoever it is that we are kind of in the presence of. I like to use the analogy for looking at how we go into explaining equanimity, kind of the way that we have a bias towards various beings, by using the analogy of yourself being on a stage. This is what Shakespeare said, right? You know, all the world's a stage, you know. So we are on our own stage, every one of us, right? Because it's all about us, right? Every one of you, it's about you, okay? You're all in agreement with that? That's what your day is like from the time you get up till the time you go to bed. It's all about you. So you're on stage. And if you've ever, you know, been on a theater stage, you know that there's the stage lights where you can see the people in the front, right? You know, so this is where we put all the people that we really like. You know, they're right in the front of our stage, and they're smiling up at us, and they're giving us all those positive signs, and they're applauding for us, all the good things that we do. You know, it's very, we enjoy pleasing them because they please us. Then we have kind of the dark of the theater, right, where the stage lights don't go, and so you can't really see who's all out there. And these are all the people that we call strangers. Pema Chodron, when she teaches, calls these neutrals. I don't really like that word so much. I know it sounds kind of strange to me. These are strangers. These are people that we haven't yet come into direct contact with. So we haven't determined kind of how to have a reaction to them. So they're sort of, we're in the dark with them. And they're in the dark to us. They're just kind of behind the scenes. They're not really somebody who we pay that much attention to. And then we have this rare bunch of people, let's hope they're rare in your lives, who keep interrupting the show. You know, these are the people who want to take over and they want to throw tomatoes and they want to do all kinds of things to make our show lousy, you know, to kind of interfere with what we're trying to do. You know, we're just trying to have a good show and they're throwing things at us, okay? So this is the group they frequently call these enemies. Enemy is a bit of a strong word in our culture perhaps, but we could use the term difficult people, challenging people. And this doesn't have to be just people that we know on an individual basis. This can be you turn on the TV or you go to the internet and you see their face there on the news and you go, ah, you know, they've just, you know, ruined your show. So these beings are all over the place, you know, and they can be not human beings as well. They can be insects, can be your enemies, the mosquitoes in the summer or something that get into your room and are buzzing around at night. Anybody who's kind of messing with your peace. So what's the problem with this? The first thing I have to say is that there is no real problem in the fact that we delineate these three groups because those beings do have a different relationship to us. The people who are in the front row are those people who befriended us, who've gotten quite close to us, who we have some sort of karmic connection with and we feel good in their presence. And again, there's some kind of synergy there that's happening. Then we also have, of course, the strangers. It's impossible to know everybody on this planet, right? You know, so there's going to be strangers in everyone's life. There are going to be those people that we simply don't have that direct contact with. And then there are the people who are enemies, you know, and difficult people who, once more, you know, we have that particular relationship with, and that's a particular category that they will fit into as long as they continue doing those things that upset our peace. So the reality is there's nothing wrong with the categorization of these three beings, if you will, or three types of beings. What's wrong with doing, with our, like, where do we go askew? Where do we go, where's the fault? Anyone? So if there's no problem in kind of having these three groups, where's the problem? And the different attitudes we have towards them in particular. What's your name?
Christine.
Christine. Thanks, Christine. Yeah. Yeah, so like we have a different attitude towards each of these groups. What's the attitude that we have towards the friends, towards the people in the front row? I mean, we do have some love. We're going to be talking about immeasurable love and this idea of loving kindness and a genuine concern for the well-being of these beings that are in the front row. We do have that, admittedly. But most of what where we go askew is we have a very strong attachment to all those people who are in the front row. We like them to keep doing what pleases us. We try to please them too, you know, do put on a good show for them, make sure that we keep them happy. But we really like it when they applaud us, when they do what we need them to do. That's the mind of attachment that we're going to be talking about as part of what equanimity is an antidote towards. We even saw that in the prayer, right? Attachment towards friends. This is one of the biggest problems that we have, is that we overlay our relationships with these beings that we have that close connection to with this distorted mind of attachment. Now, attachment is, again, a whole study where you can go into looking at the various states of mind, the delusions and what have you. We could describe attachment as simply a mind that is observing something that is pleasurable, enjoyable, and exaggerating the pleasantness of that, and then going after it and not wanting to be separated from it. These are all kind of the components of what attachment is doing when it's operative. So check out for yourself. I mean, the people who you have in your front row, you know, the people who are sitting there who you can take a look at and, you know, day in and day out and feel good about having in your life, notice how bent out of shape you get when they act in opposition to how they normally act. When suddenly they're saying things to you or doing things that are not they're not consistent with the role that you want them to play. We see that attachment doesn't like getting what it doesn't want. You know, if it doesn't get what it wants, it gets bent out of shape. And that's why we have the opposite reaction towards the enemies, the difficult people. Our problematic mind that's there is our mind of what we would even call on the stronger end of it, hatred or malice. But even on the lower end, it's kind of an irritation, an annoyance, you know, it can be an aversion. We use these various words. But the idea is with all of those, we develop a mind that is doing the opposite thing. Those beings are upsetting our peace. They're producing something unpleasant. And so we overlay, kind of exaggerate the negative qualities that are there. We make that so much more than what is actually there. And then we have this strong desire to push that away from ourselves. And sometimes we even go to extreme lengths to push this out of our lives, to push people out of our lives who are doing these sorts of things that upset our show, that cause us to have, you know, turbulence in our minds and so on. So these are the two main reactions that we're having that are problematic. And that's why in the verse it says, attachment for friends and hatred for enemies. Because these distort what's going on. Both of these minds, as I mentioned, are exaggerations. They are looking at the beings who are pleasant and making them more pleasant than they actually are. They are looking at the beings who are unpleasant and making them more unpleasant than they actually are. But we do also have a distorted state of mind with regard to the strangers. It's not as problematic in some ways, though it's akin to our ignorance, and it's the mind that we would call a kind of bland indifference. I mean, look at yourself. Again, your own experiences when you're out about during your day. And how many people do you just not even notice? I mean, who took notice of everybody who was on the road with you today driving in their cars? Who took notice of all the people that were, you know, walking around when you were doing your errands or whatever it was you did today? We tend to not notice these beings. We're kind of blind to their reality. All of those strangers that are in the dark of the theater, our sort of distorted state of mind with regard to them is that indifference. That kind of falls into a, you know, we're not taking advantage of the fact that all those beings are actually quite intimately involved in our lives. You know, we are all interconnected. This is something we're going to look at tomorrow morning when we examine immeasurable love, is the fact that we are caught up in a web of interdependence with everyone. But we're blind to those people in our theater. We don't take notice of them. We don't necessarily, you know, pay attention to them. Now, there are times when they do break through that kind of barrier or wall. We might even be watching it might be on the internet or TV or what have you, and you see a story of people who are suffering greatly because of fires or because of civil unrest or because of whatever. And your heart might be moved by those beings, and you feel some opening up and some kinship with them, some closeness to them. But most of them we're quite blind to. So the problem isn't that there's three different categories. The problem is that we have these distorted attitudes that are really blocking our potential. They're keeping us from kind of developing our heart fully. And the theme of this weekend is this idea of the kind heart and how we all have the potential to develop kindness to this limitless degree. And the very foundation that we have to work with to begin this process is to rid ourselves of these kind of discriminating attitudes, what we call a partiality or a bias. And sometimes even when it's worded, it's not in the verse that we have, we sometimes even use this idea of free from bias and partiality. These are the things that we're trying to get rid of. We're not trying to redefine everybody as a friend. That is not the job of this first immeasurable, you know, thought, is to make everybody into a friend. Because not everybody is your friend. Not everybody is going to help you. Not everybody is going to be in that category. Nonetheless, we have to get rid of the attitude that keeps us from opening our heart to them. You know, opening our heart to others is very different from befriending everyone. You know, it's impossible to befriend everyone on this planet again, but we can still have our hearts open to them. So this is what we're kind of aiming for in regard to equanimity, is, as was said by Kathleen McDonald, this unbiased, impartial attitude that regards all beings as equally deserving of our respect and concern, our love and compassion. Because what we're going to do from here, of course, as I mentioned in the Mahayana tradition, equanimity is always the foundation for developing these other qualities, for developing love, for developing compassion. Because otherwise, our love and our compassion aren't going to be complete. We're still going to be treating beings very differently, having a different attitude towards them because of the category that they fall into. So this is the important thing to understand, is that we're not really kind of getting rid of the categorization. We're simply trying to address these unhealthy states of mind. Kathleen McDonald says that actually we could say that what keeps the other three from being immeasurable is not having proper immeasurable equanimity, you know, not having developed that fully. So again, there's a strong need to start here in terms of this particular thought and to address it first, and then we can begin to, kind of on that foundation, build up the other measurable thoughts. So let's take a look, though, at these three attitudes that we have a little bit more, because I think, you know, for some of us, what we might find is as we do this work and kind of start looking at, oh, I want to have this mind that's even towards all these beings, well, we have some disturbing thoughts that we probably need to address before we can do that. So let's take a look at those three disturbing minds that I mentioned, the mind of attachment, the mind of hatred or anger, annoyance, and then this mind that we call indifference, which is actually, again, a form of ignorance, and talk a little bit about the problems of these. So from your own experience, when you have a mind of attachment towards people, what are some of the problems with that mind? What have you experienced yourself when you've had that mind? Anyone? Yeah, Andre.
Yeah, with this attachment thing, right? The moment. This
do you want to do the microphone, Donna? Yeah.
So with attachment, right? The moment that the dynamic changes. Mm-hmm. The moment that the relationship changes, then we get all flustered and we get all frustrated and we get angry, you know.
Yeah.
And so that's the thing with attachment. We have this idea that things are going to stay the same all the time,
right?
Because of impermanence, that's not going to happen.
And that's one of the big antidotes to attachment, is to reflect on the impermanence of it, that things are going to change. But you're right, absolutely. One of the things that is most problematic about attachment is that when we hold on to that view, that this is the way that that person is, and we've, of course, exaggerated that, we've made that into the whole total of what that being is. They're all delicious, delightful, wonderful. And as soon as they show us some side of that's not that, then we're like, get me out of here. So this is what we do frequently, you know, in relationships, is that people will only stay with people, particularly intimate relationships, as long as the other person keeps fulfilling that view of how that person's seeing them. So it's like, oh, as long as you're hanging out with me in that space, and as long as I'm doing that for you, then we're all going to be hunky-dory. But, you know, the second that it goes askew, well, then there's a lot of pain, there's frustration. So this is a big one. You know, we sort of set ourselves up for that by having the mind of attachment towards others. Thanks. Anyone else? Any other problems? Yeah, Donna.
I'm getting a red light here.
I think one of them is that we expect, when it involves other beings, humans or pets or whatever, is we expect them to exist for our sake.
Good. Yeah. So it becomes very much about fulfilling our needs. Yeah. And this is actually one of the things when we talk about love tomorrow, these two in our relationships with our pets or with other people in our lives that we're quite close to, these two get kind of combined and intermingled. We frequently have some genuine love, as I mentioned earlier, this kind of wish for the well-being of another. But nonetheless, we've got attachment there, and that kind of sours it. It really puts it into another category. And that's where we have all the problems. The love isn't the problem. You know, having that genuine concern for the well-being of another is what we're trying to cultivate, particularly in that second immeasurable. But when it becomes distorted through the mind of attachment, that is all about what do I need from you, and as long as you keep doing that for me, we're fine, then that's what's going to throw everything off. That's what's, you know, creates the problems. Any other things that you've noticed in your own relationships? Yes, what's your name?
Fran.
Fran?
Disappointment.
Yeah. Disappointment, okay. So disappointment. Do you want to? So there's disappointment when.
When you think that someone's going to see it your way.
Exactly.
And if they do for most of the time, and then all of a sudden, the one time they might not.
Right.
And
right.
You become disappointed. You want them to see it your way that way.
Good. That's a good one, Fran. So that's again something that we're sort of developing an expectation. Expectations are a key part of attachment. That was already a bit of what Andre was saying as well, that somebody is going to do the things in a consistent way, and we become disappointed when they're not consistent, when they show us a side of themselves or do something that's contrary to that. Absolutely. So it's, again, a setup. Attachment is a setup for disappointment, a setup for frustration, a setup for all these things. These are great. Yes. I forget your name. I remember you from last time. I'm sorry I forgot your name.
Diane,
that's right.
I am taking what others have said and realizing that not only do I want another person to respond to me in a certain way that's pleasing, I also have written the whole drama of what the interactions are going to be,
right,
and end up in serious trouble when I forget to give them the script.
That's a good way to put it. And there's no way we can give others the script, really, because everyone's going to be on their own script. Because remember, we're all on our own stage, you know. If you invite somebody to your stage, well, they're only going to think it's their stage. They're going to continue to do what they do, right? That's a good way to put it. I like that. I'll have to use that later. So these are all great. These are speaking to a lot of the problems that we have. Yes. What's your name?
My name is Noah.
Noah.
Yes. So, I see attachment actually, from my point of view, one positive and negative.
Uh-huh.
It depends upon your attitude. For negative, suppose if you have attachment to a friend,
right,
or anyone, expecting something in return.
Right.
So that is a negative attitude. If I show my attachment to this person, so that I will benefit something from this person.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
for my, you know, the worldly attachment, mm-hmm. that is something material gain or anything, that attachment is a negative.
Right.
But if I have a spiritual attachment to a spiritual teacher,
oh, okay,
like, you know, any like you or anyone, His Holiness, yeah, or Geshe-la or any spiritual, sure, teacher, where if I think that the teachings of the spiritual teacher will improve my mind,
uh-huh,
and to cultivate my compassion, then yeah, I can help other sentient beings.
Yeah.
So that attachment, I think, is a positive attachment.
Yeah. Thanks, Gawan. Yeah, I would say that when we talk about that second type of relationship with another, then that might, maybe attachment's not the best word for that. It might be something like just our closeness or affinity for somebody who's playing that role. They even say that when we look at something like our teachers or the teachings themselves, the Dharma, that we can't really exaggerate the qualities that are there, because there are amazing qualities there already, unlike the things that we are normally attached to in our lives, sense objects as well as people and so on, that we do that with, we exaggerate that. So I agree, there is sort of a healthy version of this that can be in relation to those objects of the spiritual path that we do rely upon, our objects of refuge and so on, that we can have this very beneficial relationship to. But we would probably not want to call that attachment then, because it's very, yeah, attachment's the word we reserve for the delusion, the distorted state of mind. So, but thanks for pointing that out. That is an important distinction and something that's good to emphasize, that, you know, nonetheless, I mean, I would say some people could still have a distorted attachment towards a spiritual teacher. It does happen. Or a spiritual teacher towards a student often happens too. So, you know, I think we have to be very careful and understand that just because somebody's in that role, it doesn't mean that, you know, they're free of any of that, or that you're free of any of that in your relationship to them. But ideally, if we talk about a true disciple relationship between a disciple and a spiritual mentor, then we're really talking about something that is not attachment at all. That's actually just a healthy relationship, a good relationship. But yeah. Yeah, Christine?
Oh, yeah. I'm really liking this extended metaphor about stage and script. And I was just thinking about, well, no script, it's improv. And if you've ever done improv, the first thing that you learn is when someone says something to you, you say yes and, you agree with them and move on and do something, and that's how it goes forward.
Right.
So it seems like that that's sort of attachment, just expecting it to work. If they don't say yes and, if they say, and it is weird when you're doing it and they say no, it's like you don't know where to go forward.
Yeah.
So it's And that's the way I'm thinking of it. Maybe say no, just be thinking of others by saying yes and by agreeing. I don't know. Sorry.
Yeah. I get what you're saying, Christine. And I think one thing that's been coming up and that you brought up as well is that when I talked about kind of dividing this into the three parts of your audience, you know, don't think that any one person is stuck in that. That's part of the remedy of what we're going to look at when we develop equanimity, is to really get that people will move from section to section, even within, you know, one show, even within one day, you know, even within 1 minute. You know, and so I sometimes, there's a class I've done on conscious relationship where we talk about, you know, primarily our intimate relationships, and I do the equanimity meditation with one person manifesting in three different ways, you know, because that frequently happens, right? You know, that one, you get up and maybe they start off as a friend and everything's wonderful, and later in the day that's like, what are they saying to me? God, they're so mean. And the next moment you're like, who is this person? I don't even know who they are. You know, so don't think that when I did that sort of delineation of these three groups that I've sort of set people in those seats, you know, that people themselves will wander from seat to seat, from section to the seat or to the other, depending on what their response is, depending upon what they come back at us with. You know, so it is an interesting little, you know, performance that's going on. Yes, Joan?
I'm just wondering.
Donna's getting her exercise in for tonight.
I'm wondering where our subconscious comes into equanimity. Hmm. We can sit here on a conscious level and think. Hmm. I'm treating you as well or the same as I'm treating this person over here, when in reality that may not be the case.
Sure.
And we've got all of our junk, mm-hmm. Childhood thoughts, childhood prejudices, mm-hmm. childhood memories, hurts, those things mm-hmm. that are coming and playing into those relationships. How can we recognize that? How can we bring that out, to be able to learn to see that in ourselves?
And it's a very good question. What I would prefer to do is maybe after we go through the process of developing equanimity, then we can come back to this, make sure that I do. But because I think it's worthwhile to take a look at the tools that we're going to use to develop equanimity and then to see where in that we would surface these sorts of things. Because once more, even the words that you use, though, just to go back and talk a little bit about this, in terms of treating others, we're not really talking about, kind of again, our physical actions necessarily and how we interact with others, as much as what are the thoughts that we have towards them. And are we able to kind of separate that out and recognize that, again, it doesn't mean that somebody who's like, well, again, if you're highly advanced practitioner and you're really courageous, then maybe you do go hang out with the people who really annoy you. You know, that's kind of a testing ground, you know, for developing patience and all these things. But nonetheless, for most of us, you know, we are not going to necessarily treat everybody the same. We are going to still be quite close to and do things for the people who are in the front row, because they're in our front row and that's a role that they play. But we do it with a mind that is understanding that we have an equal regard for everyone else in the theater. We don't do it just out of a bias that wants to please them so they can please us and so on. So, but all of these things that you're mentioning that are kind of in our history that might come and rear their ugly head through this process do need to be addressed, and they do come out, I think, in the meditation.
And sometimes we don't even see that we're doing it, you know?
Yeah.
We don't even notice that it's occurring. And it's this process that goes on in whatever comes out of your mm-hmm. mouth or your body language.
Right. No, it reminded me there's a lot of attention these days on racial profiling and how people have this subtle subconscious way of looking at people and having different thoughts towards them that they're not even that aware of necessarily. Sometimes they are, but they flavor how we look at others. And I guess we have kind of friend, enemy, stranger profiling to some degree too, where because of our past experiences with somebody, we'll have those thoughts that influence how we look at them. Again, and we don't want to go so far, as I said, to get rid of the label. We're not trying to just say, oh, well, this person is no longer in that category of enemy, or this person's no longer in the category of friend. They still are, but we have to get rid of the biases and these, again, deluded states of mind that are causing us not to have our hearts open to everyone. So we'll touch on that a bit. I don't know that I've got the answer to all of your questions, because I think it is something that kind of comes out in the wash. The more that we do this work, and especially that we do it with individuals, because these thoughts, and as you'll see when we get into kind of the meditations that we're going to be working with, these thoughts work with a really kind of wide blue sky kind of thinking, right? May all sentient beings. They're not talking about individuals. They're not talking about the guy that lives next door to you or the person upstairs who's really noisy or whatever the case might be. They're just saying all sentient beings. So it can become really kind of not so powerful if we just work at this level. That's why we have to work with individuals. And that is where a lot of this will come up. So, sure, yes, Anna. Yeah, microphone on the way.
I have a problem with just, I can't help but think, how do you practice detachment for your own child, your own mother, so, you know, husband that you love? That is like, especially your own child.
Right. I understand, and I think that to some degree, what we call in our culture attachment, when we talk about attachment to children in particular, I don't know that we, again, have to necessarily equate that with the delusion, much like what Nawang was saying in regard to a spiritual teacher, because I think there is something that's kind of almost biological that's happening that is there, that is important for a parent to be attending to their child in a more direct way and have that. I guess this is something that probably over time will become clearer in our own minds when we start working with it. When we say non-attachment or detachment, we're not talking about, once more, the absence of any kind of regard or feeling for that person. Rather, what we're talking about is a much more, an attitude that's much more invested in the other and is not as invested in ourselves. So it becomes tricky when we start talking about these familiar relationships or even pets. I mean, we can have a... And anytime where we're in a position where we're tending to and caring over somebody and that's our responsibility, it's not to say that we won't do that and be quite attentive to the needs of that being. But we don't let a mind of attachment come in that distorts it in terms of this delusion, that looks at it and says, I need to get this out of you for my sake. It becomes more about the love that is in our relationship, which is, I will do this for you, for your sake. Yeah. But I admit, in relationships, it is a little tricky. Venerable Rabina, when she teaches on this, you know, idea of attachment, she sometimes says that really the attachment that we talk about in our culture that's in families and so on isn't really quite the same thing. Now, nonetheless, that's because it does have some other dimensions to it, but it can still get equally distorted. The delusion of attachment is a mind that is operating from the platform of what I need and relating to others from that perspective. So as long as you're doing what I need you to do, as long as you're giving me the applause and smiling back at me and doing everything that I enjoy, then I'm going to love you. It's a bit, it's like conditional love.
But self-centeredness.
Yeah, exactly. And what we're trying to cultivate when we talk about this kind of more genuine love for another is other interested. It's really about the other person, and not that you become a doormat in the process. We'll look at that through the weekend as well. It's that you actually see that your greatest well-being comes about when you're focused on the well-being of others. But that's kind of a further along the way. But so we're Andre.
I'm sorry, I don't want to. I'm just thinking. It seems to me that attachment has sort of like addictiveness. A quality to it.
Right, right.
You know, it's like when we get to the point where I can't exist without you in my life.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
You know,
right.
It's an addiction.
Sure.
As well. And I think that's when it really gets to be really troublesome, really gets to be really ugly.
Yeah.
You know, even with the ones that we love, our children, we get to the point and say, or our spouses, I can't exist unless you're in my life,
right.
Then we need to really examine that, you know, because you know, what's going to happen when this person's not in my life anymore,
right?
You know, and so I just, that thought came to mind.
I think when Kathleen McDonald talks about that sort of negative effect of attachment, she calls it fear, because it really is this fear that arises because we're anticipating the loss of somebody in our lives and we don't want to experience that. And any time that we have a hint of that, it produces immense fear. So these are all great. These are the types of things that we do see, that we get very jealous, we get very possessive with people that we are attached to. We don't have that kind of free and easy relationship. We get very dependent upon them. You know, all of these speak to the faults of attachment. What about the faults of anger? Let me go through just a few, and you can add any if you'd like to. Obviously, you know, in the moment, has anybody enjoyed being angry? You know, if you're really, really angry, I mean, you don't really enjoy it, right? It's not a pleasant state to be. The heart starts beating, the adrenaline's rushing. It's just, it's like, it's a horrible place to be. You don't really want to get up. You don't wake up every morning and say, I hope I get angry today, you know, right? So we know it's not a pleasant place to be. It's very disturbing. It also can lead, of course, to harming others. You know, this is the problem with anger, is that it's a mind that, because of that ill will towards another person, because of those people that are interrupting your show, it can lead to harm. It can lead to physically harming them, and it can lead to verbally harming them. It also causes, you know, our suffering in the future. And this is the idea of karma that we'll touch on here and there through the weekend. I think everyone in the room's had some exposure to this idea that when we follow the mind of anger, we create unhealthy patterns. We engage in actions that will cause our future suffering. They cause suffering in the moment. They disturb our minds. They cause suffering for others. And they will cause our own future suffering. And then we could also point out to the fact that the mind of anger, yes, it's disturbing, but it's also very painful. They often use the analogy of being angry at someone is like holding a hot coal, getting ready to throw it at them. You know, so who's getting burned while you're holding the hot coal? Not the person you're angry at. It's actually very painful for yourself. So anyone else see any disadvantages of anger or faults of anger, the results that you have when you follow that mind? Is everyone's experiences, right, what I've talked about? So we know that's not a very healthy place to be. The third one is not really, it's kind of interesting because this one, because it's indifference towards those strangers, the people in the dark part of the theater, it's not a real active one in terms of causing us to experience in the moment any kind of unrest. You know, so it's not that challenging. This is why we can get away with that to some degree in our lives, is because that indifference towards all those beings who are in the dark of our theater is just kind of a blind ignorance of them. We're not paying attention to them. Well, the faults, the results of doing that are that we aren't really living up to our potential. We aren't really opening up our hearts more completely. And there will be situations, and I'm sure each of us have experienced these in our lives, hopefully not too many of them, where we won't come to the aid of a stranger, where we won't be there to benefit them at the time that they need help because we're indifferent to them. You know, they're not somebody who's in the front row under the nice lights that we can see. There's somebody who's in the dark, and we have that sort of darkness towards them. So it really does kind of limit our own happiness. It's not really good for us to continue to restrict ourselves with this mind of indifference. Kind of prevents us from achieving any great spiritual realizations, and it just leaves us with a kind of blindness to the reality of those beings. Now, as I said, people will break through that at times. And hopefully we've also had those experiences in our lives where somebody needed help. They were a complete stranger, and we willingly, gladly helped them out of the kindness of our heart. So we know that there are times that we've done both. We've been blind to the situation of others, and we've also been quite receptive to what they need. But the mind of indifference that causes that blindness disallows us from going to that place of, you know, truly benefiting others. So all three of these minds are problematic, no matter what we kind of hold with regard to them. When we talk about them in terms of them being delusions, they are going to be the source of suffering for us. They are going to keep us from achieving our full potential. So the antidotes to these, as I was mentioning, why I brought this up is because sometimes we may do this work on equanimity, and this is a bit of maybe what Joan's talking about too, is that we may find, well, you know, I'm trying to do it for this person, but I've got a lot of kind of history with them that's causing a particular delusion to be quite prevalent. I'm seeing how my attachment is so involved with that person. I'm seeing how my aversion is so strong, my hatred is so strong, that it's very hard for me to have a mind of equanimity. Well, we might need to do some additional work to address those. So the very common ones, Andre mentioned the common one for attachment, that's to think about impermanence. This is a really powerful one to do with those people who are in the front row, is to recognize that you know, someday you're not going to be on stage and they're not going to be in the front row. I mean, this is the reality that we all have to deal with. And that may not be just because of their death. It can also be because things change. People go out of our lives. I mean, think about who was in your front row when you were in the third grade, you know? Are any of those people who were in the front row in third grade in your front row now? I mean, maybe some of you have one or two people, but right, that whole front row has changed. You know, all of a sudden, you've got a whole new front row. And that we, if we look back in our lives, we see that that's the course that things have taken. We have very few people who've remained in the front row. You know, so attachment can be remedied to a large degree by reflecting on impermanence. And then, of course, we can certainly look at all the pain that's involved in our being attached to people in our lives. You know, the fact that it does cause so much of this fear and anxiety of what's going to happen when we don't have them there, all of our, you know, not wanting to be separated from them, all of these kinds of things. So these are the sorts of reflections that can be useful to kind of diminish attachment, to kind of bring it back down to a more controllable level, and then on that basis we can develop some equanimity. For hatred, of course, you know, hatred or anger, these don't arise on the basis of, you know, nothing. There's causes and conditions behind this. There's causes and conditions behind all of our delusions. But with regard to hatred, it's really useful to look at all the causes and conditions that are involved in those people interrupting our show, those people coming in and making life, you know, difficult for us. First of all, of course, in Buddhist teachings, as I mentioned, is the role of karma. That without a doubt, we've created those noisemakers. We've created those difficult people, you know. As Venerable Robina said, if you're walking down the road and someone's, you know, accosting you, that's your person to deal with. You know, that they didn't come into your life for no reason. They're there because we sort of had the setup from our side. Now, again, when we start hearing those teachings, and as I said, most of you probably have had teachings on karma, it's very easy not to fall into feeling kind of guilty and horrible about oneself because of what you have in your life, when you recognize the difficult people that you have, that you were part of creating that. We're not denying that those people are doing what they're doing from their side. They are definitely saying things and doing things that are not so kind. So we're not letting them off the hook in a sense. We're just coming to an understanding that we are a party to that. We might even be a party in the moment to that, you know, by virtue of the things that we've done that we've been somewhat negligent of, or the ways that we've not attended to others, and suddenly, you know, they're in our face. So there might be things we've done in the moment, but there certainly are things we've done in the past that have created that. And any situation comes together on the basis of a variety of causes and conditions. So we can understand that, you know, this is, I mean, I've certainly noticed, you know, in our culture these days with so much going on nationally and internationally, that there's kind of a lot of tension out there. A lot of people that are pretty high strung and just ready to react, you know. So that's a cause and condition that can make you not so inclined to get hateful of those people who interrupt your show, those people who do things that are mean. Because you understand that everybody's dealing with this, that we're in a society where that's a bit elevated. We're at, what, like the orange level or something? Isn't that the highest one of the threat level? Kind of up there these days, you know. So there's lots of causes and conditions that are behind all of this. We also have to, of course, understand that the person that is accosting us, that's doing these things to us, they're under the control of their own delusions. Nobody, you know, is mean to you on the basis of loving kindness, generally. I mean, maybe you could have some teachers who might do that as a skillful means or something. But generally, people are under the control of their own crazy states of mind when they're doing these things. So our hatred or our anger towards them doesn't really make any sense in the light of them being a person who's under the control of their own anger, their own crazy states. So this is once more another way that we can reframe that and recall, you know, that other people, just like ourselves, are under the control of the delusions. And recall what you were like when you got angry at someone else and know that it was just kind of got taken away by all of it, and suddenly you're reacting in that way. It's the same for the person in front of you. Another thing that I'd like to point out, I think this is one I actually got from Venerable Robina as well. She's one of my main teachers. She said, you know, if you think about when you yourself were angry, You know, and maybe I even challenge people to think about when you were at your worst, which nobody wants to think about, right? You know, who wants to think about when you were at your worst? Maybe, hopefully it was a long, long time ago, but at some point in your life where, like, you even are embarrassed to think about what you did or said to somebody, you know? Would you want somebody to think that that's the sum total of who you are? No, right? You know that you're so much more than that. Well, the mind of anger, as I mentioned, is looking at all that stuff that's appearing before us, that's that negative, red-faced, horrible person, and saying that's the entirety of who they are. But we know that when we were that red-faced, horrible person, that was just a moment and it went, you know, and thankfully, you know, we haven't gone back to that. You know, we haven't been at our worst again, you know. So this is, again, an understanding that we can bring to that we can start to diminish our anger so that it's not quite as strong when we have kind of doing the work with enemies, difficult people. The last one, in terms of indifference, is that we can recall, certainly, that all those beings who are in the dark at the theater are really just like us. You know, there is no difference when it comes down to it in the most fundamental way. Their sameness to us is that they simply want to be happy and they don't want to suffer. This is one of the things that we're going to look at as the rationale for why we can begin to open our hearts to all beings, but particularly with those that we're indifferent to. We have to begin to have some concern for them, begin to kind of get over that indifference by seeing that these are people just like us. These are beings who are dealing with the same reality that we all are. Another way that we can do this is by, of course, reflecting on their kindness to us. We're going to do this, kind of an explanation of this, tomorrow when we go through immeasurable love, because it's a very valuable tool to open our hearts with love to others by seeing the kindness that they've shown us. But nonetheless, these are the ways that we can kind of combat a bit of that indifference. So these three states of mind, our mind of attachment, our hatred or anger, and then, of course, our indifference, are what we're trying to get rid of in this meditation on equanimity. We're not getting rid of the categorization of the three beings in these three groups, because people are going to be in those groups. It's natural that we ascribe those groups to people, but we have to change our attitude towards them so that we can be regarding them from a more equal basis. So let's go to the sheet and talk about kind of the meditations that we're going to work with. Now, equanimity is a little bit different than the other ones. We are going to pattern each of these very similarly in terms of first working with ourselves and then beginning to extend it to others. But nonetheless, when we talk about immeasurable equanimity, the prayer itself is that others will abide in the state of equanimity. And so it doesn't even address our own abiding in equanimity, but we have to start there. As I said, without starting with ourselves, we're never going to have a solid foundation for developing immeasurable love, immeasurable compassion, immeasurable joy. So the very first step that we see on the meditation sheet there is to cultivate your own equanimity. So, again, you can use the theater analogy if that works for you. You know that you're up on stage and you can call on three people from the audience. You can say, one of the friends come up here, and then one of the strangers come up here, and then one of the enemies, difficult people who are interrupting the show, you know, to come up to the stage. And you have those three individuals that are drawn from that larger body of the three groups according to your own perspective. Now, I know that some people do say, well, how do I visualize a stranger? They're a stranger. Well, we do know kind of faces, faces that are at the grocery store where you shop, or people that you've seen, you know, even at work that you don't know. You bring those individuals forward. Obviously, you're not going to be able to work with all strangers, because there are countless strangers. The ones that are friends and enemies, we have perhaps a more delineated list of those. But with strangers, do the best that you can to just, and maybe during your day, if you're going to do this meditation during your day, just kind of have your eyes open a little bit and just kind of notice who's around and say, oh, there's somebody that I could use in my meditation. Now, the first step then after that, after you visualize these three, is to consider the particular bias that you currently have towards each of them. The attachment you have for the friend, the repulsion or hatred for the enemy, and the indifference towards the stranger, and examine the reasons why you have those attitudes. Kind of explore your own causes and conditions that have led you to regard that person in that way. Again, and part of it is, sure, they've played that role for you, but a lot of it too is the distorted state of mind that we've cultivated on the basis of how they've been towards us. So the front row, the person who's there, you know, who's our friend, we have attachment towards them because not just that they've been kind to us, but because we have come to depend upon that kindness. We have come to have all of that importance placed on that and want them to continue doing that for us. And then you can, as it says in the next step, contemplate also the disadvantages of those three attitudes to reinforce your wish to overcome them. We already talked about kind of the faults of each of those, right? Think about the faults of attachment, how painful it is to be with that mind, to be attached to others, how frustrating it can be when others don't live up to what we want, how hatred can disturb our minds, can make our minds very unsettled. It can be like that hot coal that we're holding on to. And then how indifference makes us blind to what our heart can open up to the reality of the situation of so many beings. Kind of keeps us in that state of a restriction, neglecting others through that kind of blindness to their situation. So that can be a helpful step for some of you as well to kind of reflect on those, particularly, again, if you find that the delusions are quite strong, sometimes just to reflect on their disadvantages can be really useful to diminish them. Then there are three areas. So this is kind of a bit of a new thing I'm introducing here. These are three different points that you could examine. And feel free to use any one of these or all three of these as you wish. The first one is to examine impermanence. We've touched on impermanence with what Andre has said, but here we're talking about the impermanence that is the reality that people are not set in their seat in the theater. That we have people who are continually moving, even in a day, much less a lifetime, you have people who are moving from one part to the next. As I said, who was in the front row in third grade? Well, all those people are probably out in the darkness of the theater now, you know, if they're still around. They're strangers. They're people that we wouldn't recognize on the street because we don't have that relationship with them. And we would be just as nonchalant and go right by them and not think anything of them, whereas in third grade, we would have done anything for them, right? So there's a transitory nature to these relationships. Impermanence here is speaking to the fact that there's no set role, no set seat that any of these individuals are in. And as I mentioned earlier, sometimes even one of the people might go from friend to enemy to stranger within a single day. You know, that's very possible as well. Now, that's within a single lifetime we see that that's so. If you have some conviction in other lifetimes, based on the continuity of the mind, that mind didn't start with this life, that mind existed prior to this life, that mind is always arising from previous moments of mind, if you have some conviction that you've had prior lives, well, then it's inevitable that the people who are in the front row at any one point in time have also been the people, you know, interrupting your show at another time. They've been the people that are in the dark at another time. Through the countless lifetimes that you've had, every single being has held every single seat in the theater, you know, many times. So don't think that, you know, the role that they're in right now is the role that they're always going to play. This is one way to diminish our attachment for the friends, is to recognize that the attachment is not valid in the face of those roles changing. May not be as effective for some of you. That's why we have these different things to work with. The first one, once more, being that impermanence, that there's a transitory nature to those relationships. The second one is that there's differing perspectives, that other people have relationships with them that are different from the ones that we have with them. So those people that are in your front row, are they in everybody's front row? No. I mean, some of them, they might be just disrupting their show. Some people might see them as like the worst people in the theater. And other people that are completely blind to that reality. So whose perspective is correct? If you have three people that are observing Christine, for example, and one sees Christine as a friend, one sees Christine as a stranger, and one, I hate to say it, sees Christine as an enemy. So which one of those three people is correct? All three and none of the three, in a sense. You know, because there is a relationship, you know, that is happening, that is karmically playing out, that we can't deny. Once more, that's not what we're trying to change here. But we're looking at the fact that we do have differing perspectives of this. So is my attachment to her as my friend valid in the face of her also another person being angry at her as an enemy and so on? we can kind of begin to see that these attitudes don't make a lot of sense when there's nothing said about what that person is. That person is not everyone's friend. Even the Dalai Lama isn't everyone's friend, right? You know, Chinese officials, Chinese government, you know, still don't see him as somebody who they would, you know, be happy to be with, right? You know, so there are differing perspectives for every single being. So this is another way that we can begin to diminish the attitudes that are unhealthy that we have, because we recognize that that too is just a label we're putting on the basis of our experience, but everyone else's experience could be very different. Then the third one, we did touch on a little bit with regard to the antidote to indifference, but we can use this as an antidote to all three of these attitudes, is the fact that no matter who we put on our stage, when we drew one person from the front row, one person from the interrupting people, and then one person from the dark, all three of those individuals are exactly the same in some really fundamental ways. As it says there, all of these beings have the wish to be happy and to not suffer. This is kind of the most basic platform that we work with throughout all these teachings. Because we're going to go on to develop the love that wants beings to be happy and wants to be the agent of that, and the compassion that wants to free them from suffering, and so on the basis of the fact that this is the same for everyone in the room. Everyone in the theater has that same fundamental premise. And the Buddha never said that there's a fault with that. I mean, the Buddha didn't say, oh, you guys are all wrong for wanting to be happy and wanting to not suffer. That was the starting point for everything that the Buddha taught, was that every single being wants that fundamentally. Of course, why the Buddha had to teach is because we're going about it the wrong way. We're not actually doing what needs to be done to create the causes of happiness or to diminish the causes of suffering. So every being is in the same fundamental situation of wanting to be happy, wanting to not suffer. And we can say that for most beings, until you get further along the path, you're going to still suffer and you're not going to be really happy. You're still going to be dealing with that reality. The next way that we can think about them being the same is that they all have the same basic qualities, both positive and negative, in their minds. I mean, once more, we like to paint the picture of those people who are interrupting our show as being all negative, that they're kind of inherently evil. But we know that that's not true. You know, like I quote Venerable Rabina a lot. I hope you don't get tired of me quoting Venerable Rabina, but Venerable Rabina says, you know, even Adolf Hitler loved his little doggy woggy. You know. You know, so even like the person that we can paint the worst and think, you know, oh, there were no redeeming qualities about that person at all, that they still had qualities. Maybe not the ones that the world at large saw. You know, obviously there were many, many negative qualities that were guiding, you know, individuals like Hitler and so on. But he had positive qualities too. We just weren't aware of those. We haven't really taken those into consideration. We all are a combination of these things. Nobody's complete, one or the other, black or white, right, in terms of the world at large. Get to, you know, these holy beings, enlightened beings, and maybe we can say they've developed all their positive qualities completely. But for everyone else, all of us unenlightened folk, you know, all of us still on the bus, you know, we still have a combination of these. So recognize that we're all the same in that way. The third way that we can talk about it is that the very nature of all our minds is the same, with the same potential. And this speaks to, once more, why the Buddhist path is taught, is because the Buddha says that fundamentally, our minds are pure. Our minds are like a glass of water that has that natural clarity that is currently, you know, muddied by all the dirt. The dirt of the afflictions that's kind of mixed in with the water that makes it opaque, that makes it lack that clarity. But it's only lacking that clarity adventitiously in the moment. It can be, all that mud can be removed, all the dirt, everything that afflicts our minds can be removed. And the natural clarity of the water returns when we remove the mud, so too does the natural clarity of our minds return, in a sense, when we remove all of the negativities. This is the state that all beings are in, because all beings have a mind. This is what we mean by a sentient being. In Tibetan, the word is semchen, which means mind possessor. Every being has a mind, therefore every being has a fundamentally pure mind. Therefore, every being has the potential to remove everything that is negative, to experience that natural clarity, to make that the sum total of their mind, you know, to be able to abide in that state. This is what we mean by Buddhahood, essentially, is to achieve the greatest potential to be most in touch with the natural state of our minds. You know, all the work that we're doing up until Buddhahood is to remove everything that obscures that, remove everything that's getting in the way of that being there. This is what we call our Buddha nature. You know, many of you have heard this term. And it's just essentially referring to that fundamental purity of the mind that we all have. Now again, can every being develop it to that degree in the state that they're in? Well, you know, that mosquito that's buzzing around your room annoying you is not capable in the mosquito state to do much work to clarify its mind. It's probably pretty base in terms of its what's generated in its mind and the drives that it's following for its short life. You know, but when we attain a human life like this, then we can do that work. That's why this human life is said to be so precious. It's because we can get in there and do all the scrubbing and rubbing and, you know, clear up our minds. So we all have that potential, though. And again, with the concept of rebirth, that all those beings who are born with the, you know, delusions really strong in that particular life will eventually have lives where they can begin to address that. And that's why, of course, why we want to become a Buddha, because we want to be part of the force that helps beings to do that work. So this third point, when we look at the ways that we are all the same, we see that, you know, we're all in the same position in terms of our potential. You know, I can't say that my potential is any greater than anyone else's. You know, maybe if you get into a comparison thing, you could say, well, certain individuals have gone further in doing that work than others have, absolutely. But every being has the potential for the same result, because every being possesses that same fundamental pure mind. So any thoughts on those three ideas, kind of how we can see the impermanence, the things that things are, the idea that things are transitory and changing in regard to these roles, the differing perspectives that people have of the individuals, and then the ways that we're all the same, these different ideas? Yeah, Christine.
Hi, I just want to share this. It's about differing perspectives because it's something that has stuck with me for a very, very long time. Mm-hmm. And I don't even remember where I learned it, school or workshop help. Might have been therapy. But they basically said that, you know, when we're taught the golden rule, treat others as you would want to be treated,
right,
that stinks. It should be overridden by the platinum rule, to treat others as they would wish to be treated.
Right.
So we always have to remember that.
Yeah.
What we think is good and what we would like is not necessarily what the other person would like.
Right. I agree with that. I think that this idea of the platinum rule is an important one to take into consideration. I suppose that within the understanding of that, this is the idea of why we have to become a Buddha, is because at the level that we're at, it's very, very hard for us to know what the other person needs. You know, at the biggest level, we could say, yes, everybody wants that, you know, clear glass of water. Everybody wants that state of enlightenment that is the fulfillment of their own potential. We can say that that's the same. But what an individual needs, any one of you in the room, what you need at this point in your life to help progress in that direction, I'm completely blind to. We're all completely blind to. You know, it's only those beings who've developed their mind to that degree that can teach exactly in accord with what individuals need. And I always kind of joke that I just sit up here and go blah, 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 and I have no idea if what you need to hear at all. Any one of you. You know, I kind of hope I hit the mark occasionally. But, you know, the truth is that I don't know what's in any of your minds. I don't know your karma. I don't know your own experiences. I don't know the words that will help you to, you know, resonate with these teachings. And so I just go out with what I think will be a benefit and hope that it does. So yeah, I mean, I'm doing okay. That's your thought. But I like what you're saying, because I think at the end, this is really kind of the impetus of why we need to become enlightened, is because we recognize that we don't always know exactly what the other person needs and how they would like to be treated. To have the motivation to treat them well is a good place to start. And then to say, and can I work on myself to get to a place where I can eventually know exactly what is needed by that person? Exactly how they want to be treated, exactly what will be of most use and benefit to them. So, yeah, Diane.
And before you can presume to know what another person would like for themselves.
Right.
You have to figure out what you would like for yourself.
Yeah.
And then perhaps that can extrapolate and into having the presence to give the other person the grace to communicate with you what they would like. But, I mean, this is what I finally have figured out. I don't know what I want. So how can I expect somebody else to know what I want?
Absolutely. No, I appreciate you bringing that up, too. I mean, we, as you'll see in all of these, as we go through them, we're frequently starting with ourselves. And that's because we have to do that self-investigation first. And even when we get to the end of this, where we talk about bodhicitta, it's a mind that wants to help others, but only by first helping ourselves, knowing, you know, getting ourselves to that place. So absolutely, we have to be in touch with kind of our deepest wants and desires and needs and how to fulfill them before we can be qualified to help another do that. But it doesn't mean we don't do anything along the way, you know, until then. It's like, that's the other side of it, is that we don't sit there and say, well, because I'm not a Buddha yet, because I don't know, you know, I haven't done that deeper work to know exactly what I need and want, therefore I can't help anybody. No, you do what you can. You fake it till you make it. You know, this is a big part of the Buddhist path too. And you just make sure that you're as attentive as possible and hold the well-being of others as your primary motivation. We'll get there eventually. We all will. So, yeah, Andre.
I was thinking about what you said about, like, these relationships changing, right? Friend, enemy, stranger, and so forth. And I think one of the things that we forget is that everybody that we now know that we either label friend or enemy was once a stranger.
Right.
You know, so it's like, and so I think that we have to just, I think you touched on this too. We have to have like a willingness or an openness, to allow this person to become a friend, for example, if that's what we want. When we shut ourselves off and say, "Well, no, I don't know this person. I don't care to know this person," and then that person will always remain a stranger to us.
Sure.
But if we open up, case in point. I came here today with Barry and Arlene, and I'm sorry, I can't think of your name. Fran, yeah. So it's like I didn't know Fran, you know, like at all. But it, you know, on that drive here, I got to know Fran, and we may not be best friends yet, but we're on the way, you know. So, but she was a stranger before.
Yeah.
So we just have to be willing to open ourselves up to the possibility that this person could be our friend.
I appreciate you saying that too, Andre, because I think. Again, while I can say that what I was saying earlier, that it's not about sort of putting everybody into the same category. It's not about filling the whole theater with the front row so that you bring everyone into that. That's at this stage of it that we're trying to develop that even-mindedness. Obviously, when we get further along the path and we talk about even, you know, love and compassion, we want to be holding others with a very dearness. You know, we're not talking about just kind of a blandness that we have towards anybody. That's not the goal of this meditation either. It's so that we can open our hearts equally to everyone. And frequently we're tested in our everyday lives and how far can we open ourselves up to strangers and so on. And it's important that the work that we're doing on the cushion when we do these types of meditation, that it translates into the work that we do when we're out with other people so that we're not as reluctant to open our hearts to strangers, to be willing to introduce ourselves or to, you know, begin to talk to others and so on. And it's an important part of the work. Otherwise, we're just kind of all doing it on the cushion and we're never really being tested with what does it look like to extend my heart in that way. So absolutely, it's an important part of it. So let's go through the rest of what's on the sheet before we conclude tonight. We've got about 10 minutes left. So this is what we'll do tomorrow when we arrive, is I want to go through, we'll do the prayers real briefly, and then we're going to do this meditation on equanimity, and we'll start with ourselves, just kind of generating this feeling of equanimity and even-mindedness towards individuals that are one from each of these three groups. As it says here, the effect from this meditation is to equalize one's attitudes and have a heart that is open to all, kind of what I just said, right? The goal is not to have the same relationship with everyone or deny the reality of the relationships we do currently have with others. I mean, I use the example sometimes of, you know, there hasn't been much talk about ISIS these days, but they're still doing what they're doing. You know, they're just not maybe as prominent. But, you know, there were some pretty horrible things that they did, right? And I can, if I wanted to work with developing equanimity for somebody who's doing some of that type of stuff in their lives, it doesn't mean that I, you know, say, oh, I'm going to be, have an equal regard for them and so on. I'm going to go over there and, you know, sit down with them and make them a cup of tea or something. I mean, I'll probably be beheaded in like 5 minutes or something. So, you know, there's not a lot of point in that, right? Because I'm simply setting myself up for them creating this horrible act and me no longer having this life that I can use beneficially. So we have to acknowledge that we're not talking about kind of extending ourselves places where we'll be really uncomfortable or where we'll potentially create more conflict. Nonetheless, yes, we can extend ourselves in gentle ways, you know, try to see where our heart is still closed in regard to the reality of other situations. But the goal is not to have the same relationship with everybody who's out there. But we should still, once more, is our heart open towards everyone? Are we open to the reality of the situation of others? And this is where these all start to work in tandem, because it's not just that we sit there in equanimity. We start to work then with love, and we start to work with compassion, and we start to extend our heart in those ways. So as we'll see, these all kind of build one on the other as we go through the weekend. So that's the work that we're going to do kind of on ourselves. And then we go from there to generating the wish for others to cultivate equanimity, which is what the immeasurable thought actually says, right? If we go back to the prayer, it says, you know, how wonderful it would be if all those folks were to abide, you know. Well, I guess it's not everybody else. You are a sentient being too. So you're included whenever it says all sentient beings by, you know, we're definitely on the list, you know. Don't think that you're excluded by that. But here you're trying to, having already worked on equanimity yourself, you're working with the idea of others being in that state. So having tasted equanimity in one's own mind, generate these thoughts toward all beings, whether friend, enemy, or stranger. So as it says at the top of page 2 is simply the prayer, how wonderful it would be if all sentient beings were to abide in equanimity, and so on. So this is the prayer that we use to do this, and we'll do this tomorrow again as part of our, you know, opening up to that initial thought. Now, in many of these, you'll notice that they do begin with kind of working with generating love, for example, first towards those people who are in your front row, who you're very close to. And then they start working with the strangers, and then they start working with the difficult people, and then towards all beings eventually. We'll get to that when we get to these other ideas. With equanimity, the instruction usually is given just to cultivate that thought towards all beings right from the beginning. Because you've already worked on equanimity for yourself, here it's just holding the thought of how amazing it would be if every being in the world were to have that. And we can't even imagine what that would be like without getting into love and compassion for all beings and everybody abiding in that state. Imagine if we had no attachment and hatred in this world, or everybody had an equal regard for everyone else, including all animals, insects, you know, fish, every being. I mean, it's hard to think about, but it's a pretty profound thought. So when we generate this immeasurable equanimity, we're trying to create it once more, that idea that if all beings were at least at that level where they didn't have the disturbances of these states of mind, the attachment, the anger, the indifference, that already we'd see a huge transformation in the hearts of others. It'd be the platform for so much kindness in the world. You know, as His Holiness said in that quote that I mentioned at the beginning, you know, this is, a kind heart is needed by everybody. It's not just, you know, Buddhists who need to develop a kind heart. It's every being on the planet that could benefit from a kind heart, regardless of, as you said, your race, your gender, your, you know, political affiliation, whatever it might be. You know, that if we all had that, already the world would see an amazing transformation.
It does. My religion is kindness.
Absolutely. Yeah. Yeah. So is Anna, is it Anna or Hen?
Anna.
Anna. As Anna said, His Holiness says, my religion is kindness. You know, religion is very simple. It's kindness. So this is the platform. This is where we begin, is kind of understanding that if we develop our own equanimity, then we have a taste of what's that like to wish for other beings. And we extend that out to everyone in that type of thought. Yeah, Jack. You'll let her win.
She's trained me well. I have to wait. My question is in each of these phrases that we're asked to repeat, it says, I myself will cause them to.
Right.
Help me understand how I myself am going to cause anybody to be equanimity, to have equanimity, to have love, to have compassion.
Yeah.
What does that really mean to me as I think this through?
That's a great question, Jack. I would say that this is going to come into play in the final session when we really talk about kind of how these fold into bodhicitta. But essentially, it's some of the ideas I have touched on already tonight in that if we are ever going to benefit others to these degrees, if we are ever going to help people to have equanimity in their minds, if we're going to help them to find true happiness, help them to be free from suffering, help them to attain these states of complete freedom from suffering and complete happiness, if we're ever going to do that, then we're going to have to work on ourselves. We're going to have to become a Buddha. And so this is why, again, this is a unique feature of the Mahayana tradition, is to put in that particular line, that third line that we call this immeasurable extraordinary thought, because it's similar to the extraordinary thought that we have when we cultivate bodhicitta, where we actually have that desire to, you know, make that reality. So then the question still is there, but then how do Buddhas do that? Or how do enlightened beings do that? And of course, there's that wonderful phrase, I think I even have it written on one of these pages. Let me see if I can find it. It's from the Sutras of the Buddha, where essentially it's saying that... Did I not bring it? Maybe I didn't bring it here. I'll paraphrase. Essentially, the Buddha says that Buddhas do not remove the suffering of sentient beings like you would remove a thorn from a hand. They don't wash away your negativities like they would remove dirt from a cloth. And they don't take their realizations and plant them in the heads of others. How do Buddhas help sentient beings? By teaching the Dharma. So, you know, this is the only thing in the end that even when we make these aspirations, may I myself do that, or I will cause them to have that, we're making it with the understanding that we're still somewhat limited in what we can do. You can't, I mean, if we could be instantly enlightened, the Buddhas would have done it already, right? You know, because we know that they have that incredible compassion that wants us to all be free from suffering, wants us to achieve happiness. They would have snapped their fingers and said, voila, you're all enlightened. We would have said, thank you. You know, I don't have to do all that work. So the ways that we are going to eventually be able to make that reality, to say, I will cause them to do that, is by us being a catalyst for that for them, by being able to teach the Dharma to them, be able to know their minds in the way that the conversation I was having with Christine about being able to really know what it is that others need, because we've developed our minds to that degree where we have a Buddha's omniscience. You have another question, I assume.
Well, yeah. It's the same thing. I mean, your paraphrase was beautiful, and that's what I hear, and that's where I come from and ask this question. Because even as a Buddha, the Buddha is not causing that. The conditions and the teachings are there, but I have to be the cause for me to do.
Well, let's put it in the way that there are always myriad causes and conditions involved in anything. When we say, I will be the cause, we don't mean that you're the sole cause, that you yourself are going to be the only factor involved in that. So this is, again, something we'll touch on when we talk about bodhicitta, because we recognize that we are going to be a factor, and they actually say, many of my teachers have said, that any virtue that exists in the world exists only because of the Buddhas, only because we've been encouraged to be virtuous by the teachings we receive from enlightened beings, from holy beings who have influenced us in various ways. So we can say that all the virtue there is, all the good deeds that we do, all the happiness we experience arises on the basis of enlightened beings. But does that mean that they're the sole cause of it? No, we would still say that it's karmically what we've created by virtue of being able to benefit from those teachings, the situations that we've been in where we've been able to put them into effect. So many different things have, you know, been a part of it. But they're a pretty major factor. Let's put it that way. Without a doubt, if we didn't have enlightened beings to show us the way, to give us the Dharma, we'd be up, you know, that creek without a paddle. You've heard of it. It's the shit creek. Just was trying to avoid, you know, saying that four-letter word, but I don't know. Venerable Rabina doesn't avoid it, so I don't know why I do. Yes, Andre. Wait 1 second. You get the microphone right behind you there.
I was just thinking, this may help a little bit, sir. I'm not sure. And it may just be too simple. But for me, it's like, I read the words and say, may I be the cause. Mm. Not may I cause you, but may I be the cause.
Mm. That's a good
and
way
so,
to put
and
it.
So for yeah. me, I think, you know, I can be the cause for another person's happiness. Just like a nice piece of music causes me to be happy, maybe a kind word, a kind gesture, you know, maybe a smile might cause you to be happy. Yeah. And so that's how I look at it. So I keep it really simple, and I think, well, I can do that, you know. No, I can't cause you to be happy. I can't make you be happy. I can't create your happiness. But I think I can be a catalyst. I think I can be the cause for you to be happy. So I try to be like I try to be that in my life with everyone that I meet. If it helps a little bit. Yeah.
And I think one of the things that we have to remember too is that there's also purpose to it being worded this way. I mean, I appreciate what you said. That when we generate this strong idea that I will cause them to, it is like, again, you're taking that whole burden on your own shoulders, which may be impossible for you to actually bear because you can't possibly do that for everybody. You can't cause them to have that on your own single-handedly. There are many of these sort of contradictions in the Mahayana path. For example, there's three levels of bodhicitta that you may have heard of. One is king-like, the other is captain-like, and the other is shepherd-like. And so what they say is the first one, you become like the person who is the ruler. I should have said ruler-like. Sorry, my gender bias came through. The ruler of that domain, you know, has to be in that position to benefit everybody. This is how Buddhahood actually happens, is that we have to be in a more dominant position in order to help others who are not enlightened. But the second one is a stronger mind where it's actually the captain, the person who's, you know, steering the ship, goes with everyone on the ship, arrives at the destination at the same time, doesn't leave anybody behind, arrives there with everyone else. But the third level of courage is where you're like the shepherd or shepherdess that gets all of the sheep into the flock or into the pen, the entire flock safe before they retire. You know, that's actually said to be the mind that we want to develop, that most courageous mind that says, I'm going to delay my enlightenment until all beings are enlightened. And they say that actually you become enlightened more quickly that way. So it's a paradox that even though we make these strong affirmations that we're going to act in this way, that we're going to actually do this, we actually create the opposite, that we'll never be able to actually accomplish that. We have to become enlightened in order for us to affect any of those sorts of changes. So it's a similar idea behind this when we say, I will cause them to do it. I myself will cause them. You know, it's a bit like saying, I will do this and take that full burden myself, but can you actually do that? No, it's an impossibility. Just like to say, I myself, just that part of it. We know that there's countless other Buddhas out there and there's other beings who are going to be involved in doing this work. But to make that determination that you're going to bear that burden yourself is a very powerful statement. So, I probably need to end there because it's about 9 o'clock, a little after, a couple minutes after. So, if you have some questions, maybe just write them down so that you remember to ask them tomorrow. And it is best, I'm happy to answer questions individually if you need to, but it is best to ask them in the group if you're comfortable with that so that others here, because others may have the same question or, you know, want that question answered. Write them down and we'll begin tomorrow with the equanimity meditation. And then we'll see if there's questions on equanimity before we go on to immeasurable love. All right? Let's just do a dedication prayer or two. You've got the prayer books in front of you. Go to page 235. And tonight we'll do these two prayers, and then we'll just do a couple of prayers for the long lives of our teachers. But think back over these last 2 hours that you've been here. Again, hearing words, some of you speaking words, developing thoughts, certainly, you know, all of what you've done. This is all action, whether it be mental action, verbal action. Everything that you've done has the potential to create enlightenment for yourself and for all sentient beings. But we need to dedicate it for that. We need to seal it with this prayer so that it does become the cause for the enlightenment of every single sentient being. So with those thoughts, let's read the first two verses on page 235. Due to the merits of these virtuous actions, may I quickly attain the state of a Guru Buddha and lead all living beings without exception into that enlightened state. May the supreme jewel bodhicitta that has not arisen arise and grow, and may that which has arisen not diminish but increase more and more. Then let's go to 244. And we'll do the prayers for His Holiness, and then I think last night you did for Ken Rinpoche, right, after that, and then Lama Zopa. Okay. So especially today, thinking of His Holiness's 83rd birthday, it makes strong, strong prayers, not just for His Holiness's good health and long life, but for all of His wishes to come to pass, particularly with regard to the people of Tibet. That China may change its mind, that the people in Beijing will have a change of heart, that the people of Tibet will be free once again, that the Dalai Lama can return there and, you know, bring them the precious jewel of Dharma that they nurtured for so many years and that we have benefited from. Make these strong prayers that all of His wishes come to pass. In the land encircled by snow mountains, you are the source of all happiness and good. All-powerful Chenrezig Tenzin Gyatso, please remain until samsara ends. And page 245 at the bottom. The one who mastered his speech at a very young age, the one with great patience who received the name Avatari, the one with great precision who spread the teachings of Lama Tsongkhapa on bliss and void, Lama, ornament of the yellow hat tradition, please remain until samsara ends. Then back to 244 for Rinpoche's prayer. You who uphold the subduer's moral way, who serve as the bountiful bearer of all, sustaining, preserving, and spreading Manjuna's victorious doctrine, who masterfully accomplished magnificent prayers honoring the three jewels, Savior of myself and others, your disciples, please, please live long. And by virtue of these prayers, may all of our other spiritual guides have good health and long lives, especially Geshe Gelug and Geshe Sangpo. All the other teachers that we and others have a karmic connection with, may we continue to benefit from their guiding presence in this life and all lifetimes. Okay, thank you all very much. And I will get to what you said, Joan, your question. We will talk a bit more about that. So, thank you.